Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello, hello, hello to the best audience in the world when it comes to stuff I want to talk about and stuff you want to learn about and talk about. I've got a really good guest, great guest today, one of my favorite guests, and yet I haven't had him on for 4 years. I don't know how that happened. Maybe it's because he lives in a remote, savage community called Ireland. I hear him laughing. His name is Terry Lynch. Before we now know we're both here. Before I get to Terry, what's going on right now in my world, in your world? Yesterday, I put up a blog on Madden America about some of the latest information on the Oregon shooter. The blog, by the way, has had 17,000 visitors already, which is just wonderful. Thank you for folks for tuning in to me on Madden America. It's now clearly established that the shooter was heavily involved with psychiatric drugs, no question about it. His actual screen name was Lithium Love. You didn't see that blasted in headlines anywhere. Before his blog, before his Facebook was taken down, a friend of mine took a photo and sent it to me, and that's reproduced on the article, in the article on the website, on Mad in America, in which he talks about having a bottle full of drugs that he can't even identify anymore. He's not sure which one is the sleeping pill, so he's taking four of each before he was going to bed. There's another quote there about from his mother talking to people. She probably was quite a loose tongue about herself and her son, and talking about how he had to be hospitalized at one point when he stopped taking his medications. No hint, of course, that this would be a withdrawal reaction. And just to remind you about stuff you may not have heard me talk about, and one item you haven't heard anybody hardly talk about, and that's the Aurora Theater shooter. Just a few months ago, was found guilty. They didn't accept the insanity plea, and because of one juror, he was not given the death penalty. What you have heard about, and I have this information because I was an expert in the criminal case at one point as a consultant, although I did not go to court. And what I found out was that the Aurora shooter had gone to a psychiatrist a few months before the shooting, gone to a psychiatrist at school, told the psychiatrist and the intake that he had very violent feelings. They were so violent that he couldn't tell them about them. And they got very worried about him from the beginning, which was good and concerned. And the psychiatrist that day put him on Zoloft. So here we have a young man coming in, really asking for help. I mean, it is asking for help when you go and you tell people you're violent. And the help he gets is an SSRI in defiance of all reason. She puts him on an SSRI. And he stays on the SSRI for 120 days. And that's the period in which he begins all the planning, getting all the equipment, selecting where he's going to carry out this mass murder. It's all on Zoloft. And he stops the Zoloft 20 days before when he stops seeing the psychiatrist. Shows you how obedient people remain to their psychiatrist while they're seeing them. He stopped it, but at that time, it's very clear he's in a manic psychosis. He's no longer a young man struggling with violent fantasies, which may go back his whole lifetime. He's now somebody in a manic psychosis who's been struggling with violence his whole life, drug-induced manic psychosis. And I want to remind you, because the press misrepresents this, people don't admit to this, the Columbine shooter, again, I know a lot about that. And I'm talking about the older boy now, Eric. I'm talking about that because, again, I was a medical expert in some cases surrounding it, never went to trial about any of them, but I got to see the records. And Eric was a boy not distinguished in any great way when he was put on antidepressants about a year before the shooting, when he was 17. He's 18 at the time of the shooting. And the antidepressant he ends up on is Luvox, consistent with many other information we have not long before the shooting, as Luvox has increased. And contrary to anything you may read or hear elsewhere, he had a, quote, so ironic, therapeutic level of Luvox in his blood at the time of the shootings. He'd taken the drug right up to the time of the shootings. People are getting more aware. Tom Hartman on the left has always been aware of this, and Tom had me on his show a day ago to talk about these things. And I heard today, I didn't hear the show, that on the right, Hannity is raising the issue of the importance of the psychiatric drugs. So maybe people are starting to listen more. We have a long way to go. My guest today, Terry Lynch, MD. He describes himself, and it's accurate, as a mental health activist, author, physician, psychotherapist. Notice one thing that's missing, not a psychiatrist, but a psychotherapist and a medic. I'll let him tell you about that. And he's also a husband, a father, a piano player. I wish I could play a musical instrument. An animal lover, which we hold very close to our hearts as well. And he's got an interesting childhood he may tell you about. He's written a very good book, so good that I endorsed it. I rarely have the time or the confidence to endorse a book. I endorsed his book, just out, Depression Delusion. And it's a really good book, a good critique. He calls it an introduction. Well, maybe not. Maybe that's what he calls what he just wrote. But it's volume one of what's going to be a series that really takes on psychiatry and takes it on from the viewpoint not only of a scientist doing research, but a real good, kind, thoughtful psychotherapist. Terry, welcome to the show. It's good to see you, talk to you again.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a great pleasure for me to be back on your show again. Really happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, take off wherever you want to go, sir.
Yeah. Well, you know, Peter, first of all, I think it's worth saying that, you know, I have great respect for you. You've been a part of my life, really, for 25 years. About 25 years ago, I was working as a GP, a family physician, and I was becoming increasingly uncomfortable with much of my training. And then I saw you on television, in Irish television, talking about your book, Toxic Psychiatry. And I was really intrigued by it, and then subsequently bought the book, read it, and that book really pushed me to be honest with myself about where I was going in my work, and it was a catalyst, definitely, for the changes I made. And the changes I made, you alluded to them. I basically stopped working as a typical family doctor about 15 years ago. I retrained in psychotherapy. And I set out to provide the best type of mental health service I could provide. And I've been doing that now for 15 years. And I have such serious reservations about the whole mental health system that dominates the world. And I've written 3 books at this stage, as you say, and I have many more to come. So that's a kind of synopsis, Peter.
Depression Delusion is available on Amazon, and it's really a good book if you have, as either a beginner or somebody who's more sophisticated.
Pardon?
It's a good book, whether a person is a beginner.
It's available on Amazon. It's also available through bookshops everywhere, Peter, including America. All people have to do is go in and ask for it. Yeah, I suppose the question that might arise is why did I write this book? I have it in my mind to write about 10 books over the next 10 or 12 years, setting out what I would see as a far better way to understand what are currently psychiatric diagnoses than that proposed by the medical model. And I felt that I needed to write a book that dealt with the current dominating idea, which is brain disorders and in particular chemical imbalance, because I felt that if I wrote about and expressed what I understood depression to be, for example, that the public may come and say, well, you know, we know this is a chemical imbalance. So I thought I would deal with that first. So depression, delusion, the myth of the brain chemical imbalance is really a forensic critique of the whole idea of the brain chemical imbalance, how it arose, how it was maintained, the voices, including yours, Peter, that spoke about the falsehood nature of this for the past 25 years and how that was ignored, the vested interests, a better way to understand depression. I mean, there is a better way to understand what we call depression, and it's got nothing to do with brain chemicals. And I just see the whole thing as a systematic form of misinformation and a systematic form of hoodwinking the public. And I take that very seriously. And I couldn't sleep at night if I didn't devote myself to dealing with this falsehood and contributing to the stripping away of the misinformation and the providing to the public a proper understanding of what we call depression and bipolar and schizophrenia, because the current dominating approach is completely wrong, and the public have bought into it, and it's a real shame. And those tragic incidents you mentioned at the beginning, Peter, I think are symptomatic of that.
Very, very much so. What kind of response are you getting in Ireland and in the world to the new book?
That's a very interesting question. To people who are open to the possibility that we need to change the mental health system, I'm getting a great response. To the people who don't particularly want to see change, like my medical colleagues, for example, no response at all. I have found the mainstream media not particularly interested in the book, but I have found many mental health type media very interested in it. But the public in particular, I have found, and those in, particularly those who have an interest in mental health, perhaps a personal interest or a family interest, I've really been delighted with the response. I mean, it's been doing very well on Amazon, and you know, in Britain and America, you know, it's been doing quite well in the shops as well. So I'm really pleased. It's only published for about a month. But, yeah, it's great. I'm really, really pleased. Thank you, Peter.
You know, Ireland is a relatively small country, and I don't even remember what year it was that I came to Ireland, and I spoke to it. I think it was well over 1,000 people and got on to television and radio. And there was a lot of activity going on. You were active then, and so were a lot of other people. Has the reform movement in Ireland weakened over recent years, or has it stayed about the same or grown?
Yeah.
I had great hopes for Ireland way back then, standing in front of 1,000 people.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it has weakened. As you say, I've been very involved in the movement for change in Ireland and abroad, really. About 10 years ago, the Irish government went about creating a new policy on mental health called the Vision for Change, and I was a member of that group. And when that was published in 2006, there was huge optimism in the country that we would see change. But unfortunately, that hasn't materialized, and I personally feel that is due to a number of reasons, one of the main ones being that the powers that be, in particular mainstream psychiatry, didn't really want to see the changes that were being suggested in that. And I think that it's just my opinion, but I believe that mainstream psychiatry has certainly not cooperated with the recovery-focused thrust of that document. And unfortunately, I think the impetus for change has decreased in Ireland. And my hunch is that it's similar now to many other countries. And I think one of the unfortunate things that has happened, and I imagine you may have seen this too in America, Peter, is that, you know, mental health has become almost a taboo subject. It's like you can't criticize it at all in public. People are so afraid of mental health that it's like, you know, under no circumstances say anything that might upset anybody about it, even if we're talking truth here. And I guess in my book, Depression Delusion, you know, the myth of the brain chemical imbalance, what I'm writing is very direct. It's causing, I'm sure, a sense of cognitive dissonance in people, in the sense that it's presenting people with truth, but it's truth that people are quite shocked to hear because they've been lulled into a comfortable understanding of depression and other psychiatric diagnoses as being a chemical imbalance. And that idea sort of seems to fit for people. It seems to make sense. So I come along then and I write a book which just absolutely blows that out of the water, and I think that throws people and it creates a sense of shock. So I'm not surprised at the reaction. And as you well know, Peter, you know, I'm not the first person to write about this. You've written about it and other people have written about it. But I decided to write a whole book on it because I felt it was such an important topic. I think that the idea of a chemical imbalance, perhaps more than any other, is holding back progress. Because as long as our societies see psychiatric diagnosis, which really are fundamentally various expressions of human distress, as long as societies see them as biochemical, then we're lost. You know, we're on the wrong track completely, and we'll get nowhere. But of course, the reason that it is that idea has survived so long against all the evidence is that it suits vested interests. It suits the drug companies, of course, who have made hundreds of billions out of antidepressants alone. It suits the medical profession because it's, and I discuss this in the book in terms of doctors being seen as brain experts. But as you know, and I know, Peter, psychiatrists are being seen as brain experts. But as you and I well know, psychiatrists are not brain experts at all. So psychiatrists don't investigate or treat known brain disorders at all. That's the area of neurology and neurosurgery. So, you know, this is you know, like the magician's sleight of hand. You know, it's dishonest and it's trickery. It's trickery. And I personally won't stand for that trickery because it's just too much at stake for too many people.
How far back can you trace the biochemical imbalance? I think I got it back to Eli Lilly, literally getting ready to promote Prozac before it hit the market, buying doctors to go around. Do you have any other background on the origins of the biochemical imbalance and its promotion?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the mid-50s or mid-60s. I think it was a chap called Schildkraut who came up with the theory that antidepressants, it was when the older antidepressants were out, Peter, the theory of that depression was caused by chemical imbalances. Is it the catecholamine theory and then the monoamine?
Yeah, that's right. Yes,
theory. I think it was called
catecholamine theory.
It goes back to the, I would say, 20 years, at least 20 years before Prozac was launched. It was brought in as a theoretical reason why the older antidepressants worked. And then, of course, when Prozac was being produced and marketed, they brought in the idea of a selective serotonin inhibitor. And of course, you know, the evidence, even before Prozac was launched in the late 1980s, it was very clear that it wasn't a selective serotonin blocker inhibitor at all, that other neurotransmitters were impeded as well, like dopamine in particular. But I think, you know, one of the greatest lies of this whole thing is that, as you and I know, there are no chemical imbalances to begin with. So these drugs have been promoted as treating chemical imbalances that have never actually been identified to exist. Now, scientifically, that is nonsense. That's just completely unscientific to say that these substances correct imbalances that have never been identified as existing. I mean, it's horrendous logic, really. And yet the whole promotion of these drugs was based on that falsehood.
Yeah, I think it helps people to know that actually the only way you can identify a potential psychiatric drug is that it causes an imbalance in the brain of a rat. So first you get a drug that causes an imbalance in the brain of the rat, and then you imagine it's going to be a psychiatric drug, and you start testing it and promoting it in advance as correcting a biochemical imbalance in a human. It's really quite a bizarre approach to the problem. Do you think that the
It
term
is, but I think, you know, again, it comes back again to power, to money, to profit, and to self-interest. And, you know, the drug companies have made billions, hundreds of billions out of antidepressants alone. And psychiatry, and to a lesser degree, but to a definite degree, GPs and family physicians, their status has increased in society as a result. So there have been lots of vested interests. And, of course, a very clever idea that's been promoted here, you know, down through the years, and the public have really fallen for this one. Doctors and drug companies have been saying for years, you know, it's not your fault, you're not to blame, it's a chemical imbalance. And that's a false dilemma, a logical fallacy. I've approached my book, Depression Delusion, Peter, from two principal angles, really. I've looked at it from a scientific perspective, but also from a logical perspective. And the idea of chemical imbalance in depression is so illogical when you compare it to the facts. But that idea, you know, very clever marketing strategy, but very, very deceiving to tell people, you know, oh, this is not your fault. It's a chemical imbalance. And, of course, there's such, in my opinion, unwarranted sense of blame around mental health that was a very welcome message for a lot of people to hear. And I think that contributed a great deal to many of the major mental health organizations in America and elsewhere really buying into this idea about a chemical imbalance. It sort of helped to clear people's consciences that they had nothing to do with what was going on. And I think, you know, I think it is a false dilemma, logical fallacy, because there are plenty of other ways that we can understand depression without just limiting it to those two possibilities, that it's either your fault or a chemical imbalance. There are plenty of other far better ways to understand depression.
So, are you ready to talk about the causes of depression from your viewpoint, or do you want to talk some more about biochemical imbalance? Anything more you want to say?
Sure, I'm very happy to talk about that. You know, I've been providing a recovery-oriented mental health service, Peter, for about 15 years now. It's what I do every day. And 80% of the people I see have already had a psychiatric diagnosis. Depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, OCD, eating disorders, etc. So I've become really familiar with the stories of people with those diagnoses. And I give people time, so I've really had a chance to listen very, very carefully to what's going on. And I've been trying to formulate some clarity around what's really going on with these situations. And it seems to me that, well, the best understanding I've come up with is that there are four core themes going on in all of these situations. The first is trauma or woundedness. The second is the distress in its many forms that trauma and woundedness causes. The third, then, is defense mechanisms or coping strategies that we as human beings utilize or bring into our lives to cope with, to deal with, to try to prevent further traumatization and to try to limit the distress that the traumatization we've already experienced causes us. And the fourth, then, is choice making, patterns of choice making, which is influenced by the previous three. I see those four recurring themes in everybody who attends me, whereas I have never seen in my whole life, 30 years as a doctor, any evidence of a chemical imbalance in anybody. So that's really how I go about it. And I have a chapter in the book which I call A Better Way, and that's what it's about, really. And I think, you know, this is actually you're so right, Peter, and it's so great that you and other people have devoted their lives to this, because this is a societal catastrophe. We have completely misunderstood human distress. And those who are leading the field are giving very, very bad and incorrect advice. I recently came across an article on post-traumatic stress disorder that was on the NHS, which is the UK's British National Health Service's official website. And they were talking about post-traumatic stress. And amazingly, they said that, I'll quote it here. That events such as divorce, losing your job, and failing exams, they're not traumatic. They're just simply upsetting. And I think that is symptomatic of a very definite and deliberate distortion of human distress. if you take trauma, we have put the bar so high for trauma. You know, either you've got to either, it's got to be something really severe to be traumatized. Whereas with depression, if you feel bad for 2 weeks or you have a number of other experiences, you can be diagnosed as having depression. And of course, the reason, in my opinion, is that depression, a diagnosis of depression is followed by a prescription for antidepressants, whereas that's not the case for post-traumatic stress disorder, or at least it's much harder to justify that for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I just think we have to reevaluate very seriously and very fundamentally how we understand human distress. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we human beings are fragile, that we get hurt and traumatized very easily. And that is the first step towards all psychiatric diagnoses. The problem, as I see it, is that psychiatry has a huge vested interest in maintaining the current approach, the current biologically dominated approach. Because, and again, I talk about this in my book, Depression Delusion, if the public come to see the truth, which is that there is no biological evidence of causation, that then the questions will be asked as to, well, what is psychiatry's actual role then? Because psychiatry has set itself up to be treating brain disorders. And yet, as I said earlier, they don't. Neurology and neurosurgery treat brain disorders. So psychiatry's identity is tied up almost completely with this illusionary idea that psychiatric diagnoses are fundamentally biological. So, and that is informing everything here. And so, you know, to ask psychiatry, mainstream psychiatry, to adjudicate on this or to give their opinion on this, the public have to remember how biased, because of their huge vested interests, that mainstream psychiatry is. And I think the public assume that because psychiatrists are doctors and supposed to be scientists, that they wouldn't ever be biased. But I have seen so many examples over the years of enormous bias within psychiatry in this regard.
Oh, yes. Well, in fact, I would go further and say that every psychiatrist in the field today, with very few exceptions, is a bald-faced liar, because they literally lie to their patients and tell them they have to stay on their drugs for months and years or for a lifetime when there's no evidence for that. All the evidence says it causes brain damage. They tell them they have biochemical imbalances. They tell them that it's genetic, your mother was bipolar, you're bipolar. It goes on and on. So that every psychiatrist who's functioning in a normal psychiatric fashion now is lying all the time and repeatedly to his or her patients. It's quite a stunning situation.
I think, the reason I was quite deliberate in calling the book Depression Delusion, because the biochemical imbalance idea meets all of psychiatry's criteria for delusion in the DSM. It actually meets all of psychiatry's own criteria for delusion. And, it wouldn't surprise me if many psychiatrists have managed to convince themselves that they are treating real illnesses. But I think the only word for that is to say that they, too, have managed to delude themselves. Because, as you say, there's just, it's a lie, it's a falsehood, there is no truth to it. But I think it wouldn't surprise me, for some doctors faced with dealing with people in this particular way in order to sleep at night, it wouldn't surprise me if many have actually managed to delude themselves into believing that there is some scientific logic to their ideas about brain chemicals and brain abnormalities. But as you and I know, and many of our listeners know, it's nonsensical. It's just complete lies, complete falsehood. Absolutely. It's disgraceful, really. It's a scandal happening in plain sight. It's right there in front of us. And I think in 100 years' time, 200 years' time, hopefully, if society has woken up and grown, that we will look back on this as one horrific moment in time.
That would be nice. I'm not a believer in progress. I hope for progress and do my best. And the world may get better, world may get worse, but I want to be one of those folks, and you do, who's trying to make it better, make it come out better.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think psychiatry is facing quite a difficult 10, 15 years ahead now. Again, it's very interesting how information is controlled in terms of, you know, information that doesn't suit the status quo doesn't seem to be promoted with the same enthusiasm as information that may change the status quo. And, you know, many of your listeners may not know, for example, that many drug companies have withdrawn from psychiatric research, have either hugely reduced their psychiatric research or have actually stopped it. I mean, Smith, Kline, and Beecham, a huge psychiatric drug company 10, 15, 20 years ago, the creators of Seroxit, which I think is, not quite sure what the
Paxil
American
here.
Name for that. Pardon?
Paxil.
Yes, Paxil, that's right. They've stopped their research. I mean, this is extraordinary stuff. And, of course, the reason is a really telling reason. And the reason is that they've found no chemical markers, no biological markers they can work with. So the drug companies are leaving psychiatry because what psychiatrists and drug companies have been saying exists in the brain for the past 40 years doesn't exist. It's an extraordinary situation.
They've also been pounded by lawsuits, of which I'm somewhat proud to have participated in. I think that's another reason. And the federal government here has gone after them.
Yeah.
Not sufficiently, but, you know, there's been a lot of costs in terms of litigation. But who knows whether that'll continue to happen, but certainly less psychiatric drugs is a better world indeed.
I think, Peter, that you know, the fact that there have been so many lawsuits is again, it's testament of the deception and the lies and the half-truths that drug companies and psychiatry has been telling the public over the past 30, 40 years. And the chickens are coming home to roost now. And I think you're absolutely right that has been a big factor. But again, it points to the absolute lack of science in psychiatry, that drug companies and psychiatry had to resort to misinformation, to lies, to half-truths and falsehoods to persuade the public. You know, you don't really, I know drug companies have got into trouble with drugs relating to other areas of healthcare, but psychiatry is quite unique in terms of the amounts of lawsuits. And I think it's absolutely no coincidence that psychiatry is also unique in the complete absence of any scientific foundation for what it does.
Yeah. And, you know, we want, and you are aware of this, we want to be aware that once the medical profession, and it's not just psychiatrists, we psychiatrists are the leaders in this delusion in working with the drug companies to perpetrate it. But, of course, it involves so many different kinds of doctors. But when a doctor starts giving drugs, and especially if he's doing a lot of it, that is, if he's a psychiatrist and that's all he does, he loses his empathy for people. The biological model cuts us off from understanding human beings and having empathy and care for them. Many, many years ago, Terry, I read one of the Bleuler books, I think the son of the original Bleuler. And he had this very interesting, great big tome on psychiatry at the time. It was it's more than 100 years ago now. But I used to read that stuff, and it always fascinated me. And he gave this example to prove that depression is biological, of an elderly lady who was admitted to his hospital with depression, and the only thing that had happened in her life was that her cat had died. And it's like it's a caricature of male, not misanthropy, male not understanding what makes people care and what matters to people, to dismiss a woman, an older lady living alone who loves her cat and has probably had it for a decade and who loses her cat as being a really almost end-stage trauma in her life. It's just corrupting to want to look at people biologically.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, why would doctors want to do that? I think that's an interesting question. And I think that psychiatrists became seduced by an idea 50, 60 years ago. Psychiatry, as you know, by going back to psychoanalysis, psychiatry was seen as the poor relation of medicine. And the idea that psychiatric diagnosis might be biological in origin was so seductive for psychiatry, it was so attractive. It helped psychiatrists to feel that they were equal to their colleagues in neurology and cardiology, that they too were treating biological illnesses. And they became so enthusiastic about the idea. And they lost their logical, they lost their reason, really. They went way ahead of themselves and assumed all sorts of things. And the fundamental reason was that it made them feel better. In my book, I've quoted Nancy Andreasen, a very influential psychiatrist. I'm sure you're well familiar with her work. And in 1984, in her book, The Broken Brain, she wrote that the biological revolution has already occurred. In other words, it's done, it's over, we know that this is all biological. And that was 1984, that's 31 years ago. And yet, you know, Thomas Insull, the NIMH head, I think he may have changing jobs soon, but he recently said that we're on the cusp of a biological revolution. That was 30 years after Nancy Andreasen said that the biological revolution is over. So I think psychiatry allowed itself to lose its perspective, to lose its discernment, and become completely off track, seduced by the hope that they too would be seen as real doctors. And of course, these real doctors, these consultants, yes, they have some empathy. That's, I'm talking about cardiologists, neurologists, etc. I'm sure many of them are empathic, but their fundamental priority is the biology and the pathology that's going on. And I think that's one of the reasons why psychiatry has lost its empathy. But you're so right. I mean, what you say touches on another issue that I see all the time, which is, you know, doctors make a very, very fundamental error of judgment. I think it was Carl Rogers, and mentioned the term, or came up with the term, accurate empathy. And I'm conscious that the empathy is such an important concept for you, Peter. But Carl Rogers' idea of accurate empathy is such a fantastic idea, because it's about not looking at it from your perspective or my perspective, but looking at it from the perspective of the person. And that psychiatrist completely failed at the first hurdle, which was to see that to this person, this woman, that cat may have symbolized everything that was worthwhile in life. And when the cat died, you know, maybe she just surrendered. And, you know, if we get it wrong in the first rung of the ladder, then how on earth can we help people?
Well, exactly. And I think you can be a cardiologist and be empathic, because
when you're
talking with your patient, you're not making believe that their heart disorder is literally the only reason why they they're having one or another feeling. But actually, you know, it's confusing, because people can get sad about their heart disorder, and you can be empathic about it. You can still be empathic to the whole person and be a surgeon.
Absolutely. I think there may be a reason for that. I think that the cardiologist has nothing to hide. The cardiologist knows, you know, he has a sound scientific basis to what he does. So he doesn't have to distort his interpretations. Whereas the psychiatrist, I think, is still trying to convince himself that depression and other conditions are biological. So in order to convince oneself, themselves, of something that isn't true, they have to exaggerate and distort. And I think the risk may be that if psychiatrists, well, I mean, some psychiatrists are empathic. I don't want to say that all psychiatrists are not empathic, but the more empathic a psychiatrist is, I think, the more challenging and challenged the beliefs about biology become. So I think that many psychiatrists are protecting themselves from looking at the truth by distancing themselves from the patient.
Absolutely. Let's talk some more about what you do as a therapist, and also how does it work in the health system of Ireland for you to be a physician practicing psychotherapy?
Sure. I'm not involved in the health system as such. I mean, what I do is not supported by the health system.
The health system
is dominated by the medical model, and I had to walk away from my medical practice and start up my own particular way of working. But people attend me privately from all over Ireland. I do Skype sessions with people all over the place, all over the world. I'm doing Skype sessions with people in Australia. So, you know, I'm very busy, but it's the health system here doesn't it's beyond what the health system here will see as the right way to go, let's put it like that. I suppose I start from the position that recovery is possible. You know, the idea that psychiatric diagnoses, all of them, are lifelong conditions. You know, scientifically, there's no evidence of that. And I know many people with a diagnosis of bipolar, schizophrenia, OCD, etc., who have made full recoveries and are off medication and leading effective lives. So I know that recovery is possible. So that's one of the things I do. I have an attitude that sees recovery as possible. So I start from the premise that I try to work with the person, first of all, to make sense of their story, you know, to see the rightness of the story rather than the wrongness or pathologize. And that can be very helpful to realize that, for people to realize that they're not actually going crazy, that there is a logic to their voices, there is a logic to bipolar, there is a logic to depression. And that's a great help for people to realize that what they're experiencing makes sense. And quite often I'm the first person who has said that to them, particularly the first professional. I listen very carefully. I give people time to tell their story. Quite often people have never had the opportunity to tell their story without being interrupted continuously or somebody feeling they have a more accurate understanding of their story than they do. I look for, I suppose, recurring themes. 4 years ago, Peter, I wrote a book called Selfhood, and the reason I wrote that book was that I had noticed that a recurring theme in people, I would say virtually everybody I've seen with a psychiatric diagnosis, is that their sense of self is hurt and wounded and reduced. And I wrote that book because for that reason. And I work, so the idea of helping the person to raise their sense of self is a core aspect of what I do. I look at the person's protective mechanisms. How do they protect themselves? And in other words, the various defense mechanisms they use, and try to explore that with the person. And you know, I think many of the features of depression, schizophrenia, bipolar, they're actually part of the defense system the person has created. And I think that's a very important point, because quite often these are the person's best solutions that they have come up with so far. And if we go and try to take away people's solutions, they may panic and work against us. So there are some of the things I do. I look at how the person handles emotions, look for patterns in how they handle emotions. Quite often, I think there are patterns of dysfunctional handling of emotions. And when I say dysfunctional, all I mean is that they're not really working. But the person has cultivated that way of dealing with emotions based on how their life has evolved. So to me, I respect hugely the sovereignty of the individual, and I gently work with them to try to help their life, get their life back on track, to try to finish emotional unfinished business, to address some of the things that have been going on, so some of the patterns such as perhaps avoidance and withdrawal and shutdown, and help people, say, with a diagnosis of bipolar to understand the triggers, the emotional and psychological aspects to these diagnoses, because you know bipolar and schizophrenia, they're such a huge aspect of emotionality and psychology in those experiences that are routinely missed by the services. There's some of the things I do for them.
You enjoying yourself being a therapist out there?
Yeah, very much. I suppose I call myself a mental health professional rather than therapist, really, because to me it's about one human being connecting with another and, you know, sharing the human experience, really. I've had my own traumas and woundedness. I've had my own distress. I've had my own defense mechanisms. I've had my own anxieties. So I really enjoy the privilege, I think, of connecting in with people on such important issues, you know. And to me, the work, although I don't go into spirituality particularly in the work, but I see the work as very spiritual in the sense that it's two human spirits connecting and trying to relate on a very real, honest level. And to me, that's a privilege, and it's special, and it's, you know, sadly uncommon in our society.
I really hold that dear myself. I really view it as a special privilege to be able to talk with folks so intimately about their lives, and occasionally, yeah, but not so much, about my own life, to make them feel comfortable with me, at least.
Yes, exactly.
And you said you don't talk specifically about spirituality. I do. If the person wants to talk about it, I jump right in, feet first. Tell me about your reluctance.
If the person wants to, yes, of course. But
don't
what
the
I mean
Irish,
is, I
the
suppose,
Irish are the most spiritual people on earth, aren't you?
Yes, that's very true. It goes back to Celtic times a long time ago. That's right. Absolutely, Peter. I mean, I'm happy to talk about whatever is important to the person. Of course, yes. I suppose I'm just conscious that spirituality is such a personal, private thing that, you know, I'm mindful and respectful that it should be client-led, if you know what I mean. Of course, if the person wants to talk about it, then of course. And it is part of the work, of course. I just think it's such a particularly precious thing, spirituality, that while it's there, you know, it isn't often necessarily named, if you know what I mean. But it's always present. I mean, it's two spirits, two human spirits engaging together. It's very special. And, you know, I often come home feeling, my God, what a privilege it was today to be with people.
It's wonderful, Terry. I often feel that way myself. Gosh, I've been doing therapy since 1968, and I first started working with patients face-to-face in college for 4 years as a volunteer in 1954.
I remember that in your book, Toxic Psychiatry, yeah.
And it's never become boring to me. It's never become frustrating deeply. Sometimes individually, yeah, it's, you know, I wish so much I could help more than I do. But it's always been a refreshing and a wonderful experience to see people, yeah, visit with them and to offer them help. I can't imagine that it would be that way if I was giving medications out. It would just be horrific.
Yeah.
Depressing,
yeah, I agree.
And boring.
I sometimes meet medical colleagues and other family physicians and general practitioners, and I'm just so grateful that I, you know, 20 years on, I'm not doing that work. Of course, family physicians and GPs do a very fine job in lots of areas, I know that, but, you know, I can see it in some of their faces that they know, as you said earlier, they know that they're not telling the public the full truth in mental health. And I know they feel trapped in the system, and, you know, many of them say that to me, you know, that they're trapped and they don't know what else to do. But, you know, I don't think that's a good enough excuse. I think that we should stand up and be counted. And I think that, as I can't remember who said it, but, you know, it was a very well-known saying, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I guess that was one of the turning points for me. I reached a point where I just could not be part of the problem anymore. And a thought that often strikes me, and it was definitely one of the motivating factors for me over the years, is that someday I'm going to be on my deathbed, and I'm going to want to look back at my life and feel that I was as honest as I could be and as real as I could be. And I know that if I continued working as I was, I'd have great difficulty on that day, I think, on the day of my death, trying to reconcile working in one way and yet knowing that it wasn't correct. And I'm reminded of Daniel Carlock, you know, the American psychiatrist, and his book Unhinged. You're probably familiar with that, are you, Peter?
Yeah, tell me again his name. No, I'm forgetting.
Daniel Carlock. He's an American psychiatrist, and he wrote a book called Unhinged. Now, the full title, I'm not quite sure, but Unhinged, The Problem with Psychiatry.
Yeah, I've never met him or talked with him. Yeah.
Pardon?
I've never met him or talked with him.
Yeah. No. He writes in his book, there's a reason I'm mentioning it. I mean, it was quite a good book, but I thought that, like many psychiatrists, his understanding of anything outside the psychological or psychiatric field was somewhat limited. But the reason I'm mentioning it is that he was very honest about antidepressants. And Actually, it may not have been in that book. It may have been in an interview he gave on radio. But he said, you know, he was asked about chemical imbalances and antidepressants, and he said that, you know, he does tell people he had just earlier that day told somebody that he prescribed an antidepressant, and he had told them that it would balance their chemicals. And he actually said, I think it was the interview, he said, I tell them that not because I believe it, but because the patient needs to feel that the doctor knows why they're prescribing the drug. And I thought it was hugely honest of him to say that. But, you know, to say something he doesn't believe in order to convince the patient to take the medication, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that in sleep but at night. And I think a lot of doctors find themselves in that situation where they do that. And, you know, to me, that's just not okay. It's not okay to tell people something as a fact or almost definitely as a fact when we don't believe it ourselves. It's not okay, Peter, you know?
No, it's not. It is a profession that's deluding itself and trying very hard to delude everybody else so that they can have power, authority, income, and the identity.
I think part of the problem, too, Peter, is psychiatry, mainstream psychiatry as it is, has put all of its eggs in this basket. It's put all of its eggs in the biological basket. So it's clinging to this for dear life. And the public don't realize that. The public think that psychiatry is balanced, is open-minded, and that the reason that mainstream psychiatry doesn't take a trauma-type perspective is that, well, that the science is there to justify what they do. And the public need to really get real, get informed about this, that psychiatry is so dependent on the continuing deception of the public. If the public really find out the truth, which is that there is no scientific basis to either chemical imbalances or other brain statements that people make, doctors make about depression and schizophrenia, etc., then psychiatry is going to find itself in really hot water trying to explain and justify itself and its behavior. And I think that could be when the downfall of psychiatry comes. And personally, you know, the downfall of psychiatry in its current form is certainly something I would support and I'm working towards.
Oh, God, there's no doubt about it. One of the things I've done recently, I don't know if you know, I published an article in a journal called Childhood and Society, and giving some of the data about what we do to children with psychiatric drugs and saying to professionals, it's time for us to just come out and say that, especially in regard to children, we have to stop giving them any psychoactive substances for the control of their behavior or mental life. We just have to stop. We have to call for an absolute stopping of drugging the kids.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it seems like common sense.
I think the public are the sleeping giant here. You know, I think the public assume that psychiatry has a scientific basis, and I think if the public really hear that it doesn't have a psychiatric basis, then I think there could be quite a major backlash against the psychiatric model. Can I just read you something, Peter? In terms of chemical imbalances. You know, this nonsense is still going on. I'm looking now at an article in front of me on the internet from the October 5th, which is yesterday, it's called MedGadget. No, I'm not really sure who they are, but it's basically a financial paper about, you know, future market prospects, etc. And the title is Global Schizophrenia Therapeutic Market. China and India are expected to be the fastest growing market by 2021, right? And I'll just read you three or four lines. It's talking about schizophrenia here. People with this disease have imbalance in neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine, responsible to allow nerve cells to send messages to each other. This chemical imbalance affects the thinking of the individual. Now, you and I know that that is complete lies, and yet this is what's being put out there to the public, who naturally take it as truth. I know of no other area of medicine that is persistently misinforming the public, systematically misinforming the public. You take depression, any of the psychiatric diagnoses. I mean, as you well know, there are no tests for any of these diagnoses. So There's no test for, there's no biological test for any of them, for schizophrenia, bipolar, none of them. And as you also know, Peter, you know, psychiatrists and GPs, family doctors, often compare these diagnoses with diabetes. And yet scientifically, and I have a chapter in my book about that, scientifically the two could not be more different. If a doctor diagnosed diabetes the way they diagnose depression, he or she would find himself in a very serious medical litigation situation and would be most likely complained to their medical regulating body. In Ireland, it would be the Medical Council. Any doctor who would diagnose depression or diabetes without either a blood test or urine test would be seen as operating malpractice. And yet, that's how every psychiatric diagnosis is made, without any reference to tests. As you know, there are three pillars to the diagnosis of medical conditions. There's the history taking, there's the physical examination, and there are the investigations. And the vast majority of medical conditions are diagnosed using all three, or at least two of those three. You know, either there will be investigations that are specific for the condition, as there is, say, in renal brain disorders like multiple sclerosis or brain tumors, etc., or there will be specific physical findings relating to that condition. And in all of the psychiatric diagnosis, none of those apply. So the science behind the diagnostic process is so weak. It only relies on one aspect, and that's the history. And that's unheard of in medicine, in terms of the entire diagnostic process in psychiatry is based solely on the history. There are no confirming tests whatsoever. And even worse than that, it's based on one particular way of interpreting the history, like the psychiatrist you mentioned who interpreted a particular wrongly how that woman reacted to her cat dying. It's worse than kindergarten science. It's terrible. It's diabolical.
And that's fraud. It's
we
diabolical.
Really have to change this.
Yeah. Terry, we have about a minute left. In fact, we have a minute left. And how do people get a hold of you? Suppose somebody wants to talk to you and Skype with you.
Sure. My website is probably the best way. It's www.drterrylynch.com. That's D-O-C-T-O-R. www.drterrylynch.com. And my email address is on that. And people can get two free chapters of my books by just logging onto the website. One chapter of my new book, Depression Delusion, and one chapter of Selfhood. And that will give people a flavor of where I'm coming from in this area, Peter.
That's wonderful, Terry. Don't let me go 4 years without having you on my radio show. And if you're writing a book a year, that surely gives us an excuse to get together and talk at least once a year. My distant
Absolutely,
friend,
Peter. I would really like that. And again, I will say to you, Peter, I admire you so much. I think you have been a pillar of truth in mental health for so long. You've been pilloried, but you haven't let it stop you, and you've been a great inspiration to me. You know, I could count on one hand the people who have been enormous inspirations to me, and you're definitely one of them. And, of course, Robert Whittaker, another great inspiration.
Thank
and
you.
Robert did me the honor of writing the foreword to Depression Delusion. So I feel very privileged. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Terry Lynch. Folks, go to his website, get his book. Thank you.